Imagine a new breakthrough medication hits the market, right? Let's say it's a highly advanced biologic for severe asthma or something.
Right, or like a targeted therapy for a chronic disease.
Exactly. And you see the headlines, you hear about the trials, and then boom, you see the sticker price.
Oh, yeah, the sticker shock is real.
Right. Millions of dollars for a national rollout. And your immediate instinct, especially if you're managing a public healthcare budget, is just to brace for impact.
Yeah, the assumption is always that buying this incredibly expensive new drug will just, drain the system's resources entirely.
Right. It threatens the financial stability of the whole program. Okay, let's unpack this because today we're diving into a massive sweep of economic data that suggests that instinct is, well, entirely backwards.
It really is. It turns out that spending more money upfront on expensive new drugs doesn't actually drain the system.
No, it actually shrinks the total healthcare budget by tens of billions of dollars over time,
Yeah.
which is wild to think about.
It completely flips that traditional narrative of healthcare sustainability right on its head.
It really does. And to help us navigate this, we are looking at the source material you share with us. It's a deeply researched article from May 2026.
Right, from the Canadian Health Policy Journal.
Yeah, authored by Brett J. Skinner. And the title just lays the mission out perfectly. It's called The Impact of Innovative Medicines on Healthcare Costs in Canada, 1990 to 2024.
So we are unpacking 35 years of macroeconomic data here. We're going to see how pharmaceutical innovation actually functions in the real world.
Right. But to appreciate the math, I feel like we first need to understand the mindset that this paper is trying to disrupt, you know?
Absolutely, because it is a deeply ingrained assumption. We're all basically conditioned to view public budgets as this strict zero-sum game.
If I spend a dollar here, I lose a dollar there.
Exactly. The prevailing logic for governments is that if you spend a massive amount of capital on a new pharmaceutical intervention, you inevitably have fewer dollars for hospital beds or physician salaries.
Right. They see the new drug as this budget-busting liability.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of, well, it's like someone refusing to buy a high-quality, fuel-efficient car because the sticker price is high,
Well,
right?
that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. So instead, they opt for this cheap clunker, completely ignoring the fact that the clunker is going to bankrupt them in repair costs and terrible gas mileage over the next decade.
Yeah, and this new paper actually builds on some existing research that proves that exact point. Skinner specifically highlights Frank Lichtenberg's work from 2025.
Oh, right, the historical study. That was fascinating.
It was. Lichtenberg looked at the long-term ripple effects of early access to new drugs approved way back between 1970 and 1991.
So he was measuring interventions over decades. What did he find?
The outcomes were staggering, honestly. He found that by 2022, having early access to those historical drugs saved 847,000 Canadian life years.
Wow, over 800,000 years of human life preserved, just because the drug was available early.
Exactly. But the infrastructure savings are what really set the stage for Skinner's new test. Lichtenberg calculated those early drugs saved 14.2 million hospital days.
14.2 million days where a bed was empty instead of full.
Right. And in financial terms, that translates to $78.7 billion in hospital savings.
That's almost incomprehensible. The source even notes that $78.7 billion is twice as large as the total national expenditure on all prescribed medicines in 2022.
Yeah, it's huge.
So the system basically paid for the entire national drug budget twice over just by keeping people out of the hospital.
Precisely. But, Lichtenberg was looking at drugs from the 70s and 80s. Medicine has changed a lot since then.
Right. We're in the era of complex biologics now, gene therapies.
Exactly. So Skinner wanted to test if this dynamic still holds true today. He wanted to definitively prove if modern, highly expensive innovation still saves money system-wide.
Which, as a student of this stuff, feels like a massive analytical headache. How do you prove that across an entire country over 35 years?
It's a huge hurdle. There's just so much statistical noise over 3.5 decades.
Yeah, because you have recessions, the population ages,
Yeah.
inflation changes what a dollar is even worth. You can't just draw a straight line between drug spending and the total budget.
Right, you can't. So to solve this, Skinner used a statistical tool called a multivariable linear regression.
Okay, let's break that down for me like I'm a student. Multivariable linear regression.
Essentially, its goal is to mathematically untangle all those competing factors you just mentioned. It isolates the pure economic impact of the drugs themselves.
Okay, so it's like, let's say I'm trying to figure out if adding a premium baking powder makes my cake rise better.
Okay, I like where this is going.
But to prove it's the baking powder, I have to make sure I'm not accidentally measuring the oven temperature or the altitude or the fact that I used a different type of flour, right?
That is exactly it. You have to control for the background noise. So let's walk through Skinner's ingredients, so to speak.
All right, what's the cake in this model? The final outcome.
The cake is the dependent variable. Skinner labels it PubHex, which is overall public healthcare expenditures.
PubHex, got it. So we want to know what makes total public healthcare spending go up or down.
Right. And the premium ingredient, the catalyst we're testing, is the independent variable. He calls this PMX.
PMX. So that's the patented medicines expenditures. The money spent on new innovative drugs still under patent.
Exactly. But to make sure we aren't measuring the oven temperature, we need our control variables.
The friction of the real world.
Yes. So he accounts for hospital expenditures and FEACE-X, which is physician expenditures.
Okay. What about the economy and population?
He includes GDP for the broader economy and inflation, POP to track the population size, and simply YR, or year, to track the passage of time.
That makes perfect sense. Obviously, if a country grows by millions of people, they're going to use more doctors. Total spending goes up just from demographics.
Right. And this regression model mathematically filters all of that out, leaving a clean view of what happens when you turn the dial purely on patented medicine spending.
And this isn't just a snapshot. This is 35 years of continuous data. From 1990 to 2024.
Yep, using incredibly robust data from the Canadian Institute for Health Information and the Patented Medicine Prices Review Board.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. When you run 35 years of data through this rigorous filter, what does the regression actually find?
It reveals basically the statistical holy grail. The coefficient for the patented medicines variable came out to -3.395.
-3.395. Wait, so a negative relationship means as drug spending goes up, total spending goes down.
Yes, in plain English. For every $1 million increase in spending on patent medicines, there was a $3.4 million decrease in overall public health care spending.
I need to pause on that because that is staggering. A 1 to 3.4 ratio.
It's massive.
You spend $1 million on a fancy new drug and the overall budget literally shrinks by $3.4 million. It completely destroys the idea that these drugs are a liability.
And that ratio held strong even after controlling for population growth and inflation and everything else.
So what happens when you scale that up to the macro level over the full 35 years?
The cumulative totals are breathtaking. Between 1990 and 2024, Canada spent an incremental $20.4 billion on new patent medicines.
Okay, so a $20.4 billion upfront investment.
Right. And because of that 3.4 multiplier, it generated $69.3 billion in overall public healthcare savings.
$69.3 billion. That is unbelievable.
To put that in context, if those drugs hadn't been introduced, public healthcare spending would have ballooned to nearly $297 billion by 2024.
Instead of what they actually spent.
Yeah, the actual amount spent was contained at $227.7 billion.
Okay, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second, though.
Go for it.
The paper uses list prices for these drugs, right? Like the official sticker price?
No.
But governments never pay the list price.
They negotiate secret discounts. Yeah.
Right. Highly confidential rebates. So if the government actually spent way less than the official data says, doesn't that hidden discount completely mess up the math?
What's fascinating here is that Skinner actually anticipated this exact critique.
Oh, he did. How do you account for a state secret discount?
He essentially stress tested his own model. He ran a secondary calculation assuming a massive standard rebate across the whole 35 years.
So a worst case scenario where the government got huge invisible discounts on every single drug. What happened to the $69.3 billion in savings?
It dropped, naturally, but it didn't disappear. The savings only dropped to $52.5 billion.
Wow. So even if you bake in massive secret discounts, early access to new drugs still generated over $50 billion in net savings.
Exactly. It's still a massive net positive. And it proves this concept economists call virtuous technological substitution.
Virtuous technological substitution. I love that term. That's basically substituting an older, really expensive intervention with a new technology, right?
Precisely. Like severe cardiovascular disease. We used to rely on invasive open heart surgeries, weeks in the ICU, massive rehab.
Right. Millions in hospital resources.
But today, you can stabilize a patient with an advanced lipid-lowering biologic. They self-administer it at home. They never need the surgery.
So the drug physically replaces the hospital bed. It's preventative infrastructure.
Exactly.
Okay, so if the 35-year data proves this beyond a shadow of a doubt, surely Canada is rushing to get these drugs to patients immediately, right?
You would think so, but the paper points out the exact opposite is happening.
Yeah, there is a huge disconnect here, and it comes down to how these insurance plans manage their approved drug lists, right? Their formularies.
Right. There's a big difference between an open formulary and a managed formulary.
And private insurance typically uses open formularies.
Yeah, with an open formulary, once Health Canada says a drug is safe and effective, the private plan covers it by default.
They just trust the innovation and absorb the cost because they know the long-term value.
Exactly. But public provincial plans, the taxpayer-funded ones, they use managed formularies,
which are basically designed to be restrictive.
Highly restrictive. The default is no coverage. Even if Health Canada approves it, the public plan forces the drug through a massive bureaucratic review.
They do their own health technology assessments, they renegotiate, they stall. And the stats on this are jarring. Let's look at the window from 2019 to 2023.
So in those 5 years, Health Canada authorized 196 new active substances. Safe, effective, novel innovations.
Okay, 196 new drugs. How many of those actually made it to the public by the end of 2024?
The coverage was abysmal. In British Columbia, the public plan only covered 11% of those new drugs.
Wait, 11%. So nearly 90% of life-saving medical innovations were just withheld from public patients there.
Yep. And the best performing provinces, Ontario and Quebec, they only maxed out at 27% coverage.
That is deeply frustrating. But it's not just the coverage rate, right? It's the wait times for the few drugs that do get approved.
The delays are immense. From the moment Health Canada authorizes it, patients wait an average of 566 days in Alberta.
566 days.
And it scales all the way up to 816 days in Prince Edward Island.
Over 2 years. Let's just reflect on the human cost of that for a second.
Right.
An 816-day wait for a life-saving medication.
It's agonizing.
You know, a cure or a treatment exists. The government says it's safe, but you can't have it because some administrator is haggling over unit prices to protect their siloed drug budget.
And while they wait, the patient gets sicker, they go to the ER more, they degrade, they end up hospitalized.
Which bleeds the hospital budget.
Mm-hmm.
They're rationing care to save pennies on drugs while hemorrhaging dollars on hospital beds.
Exactly. And the regression model doesn't even capture the societal costs, the lost wages, the economic productivity loss because someone is too sick to work for 2 years.
So what does this all mean? We have the data. We see the broken managed formulary system. How do policymakers actually fix this?
Well, the first thing is they need a major reality check about how much they're actually spending.
Oh, the 1% stat. Yeah, let's talk about that.
Net direct expenditure on patented drugs by provincial public plans is actually only 1.0% of total public health care expenditure per capita.
Wait, really? 1%?
Just 1%.
So all this bureaucracy, the 800-day wait times, the agonizing delays, it's all to aggressively control 0.1% of the budget. Cost is an imagined barrier.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, Skinner's main argument is that Canadian policymakers have to stop obsessing over upfront prices.
They need to adopt open formularies in the public plans.
Exactly. Give patients access immediately, capture that systemic value on the back end, the avoided hospital costs, the better health outcomes.
They have to be willing to slightly increase that 1% slice of the pie to shrink the other 99% over time.
Right. Trust the macroeconomics over the short-term ledger.
It's just so compelling to see it laid out mathematically. So to wrap this up for you listening, we've just learned how a complex 35-year regression proved that buying innovative medicines actually reduces total healthcare costs,
yielding a 1 to 3.4 return on investment.
Right. And how the current policy of rationing these drugs is actively harming the exact financial sustainability it claims to protect.
And, you know, it leaves you with a really provocative question to mull over. If rationing new drugs is actually a false economy that drains the system elsewhere, how many other areas of our public infrastructure are trapped in this exact same paradox?
Oh, wow.
Right? From education to clean energy grids to preventative medicine, are we just saving pennies today only to waste dollars tomorrow?
That is a fantastic point to end on. It really makes you look at every government budget differently. Thank you so much for sharing these incredible sources with us and for going on this journey into health economics. Stay curious, keep questioning the consensus, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.